I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and as always, I am thrilled to be here with you. So today, we have a little theme of law enforcement. I think that's where we're going to kind of steer this episode. We have a major American election that's going to choose the next president of the United States, or it's going to be the biggest debacle the world has ever seen when it comes to politics. Now, we all think we are immune from the frailties of the rest of the world. And for the most part, for most of our modern existence as a country, we have been free of the frailties of the rest of the world. We don't have political implosion where our country falls apart because of a political situation. We have unbelievable transfer of power over the years from one party to another very peacefully. People change hands. They shake hands, both new president and old president ride together in limousines. Their teams work together so that we can better prepare that transition so that the next party comes in, they get to run the country the way they see fit for the next 4 years until there's another election. Now, we have seen a change in that paradigm, this past change. We've seen the radicalization of the Democratic Party, and there's no other way to put it. I like you all know, I try and look at things pretty fairly, pretty evenly. I don't take a side based on my ideology. I take a side on based on what I see in front of me. And what I have seen over the years is while there was always an undercurrent of socialist tendencies in the Democrat Party, going back to the beginning of our modern era, even with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and all the things that he did were socialistic. Now, you can certainly make a case that at that time, after the economy crumbled, after a world war, there was a reset that was needed and millions of people needed assistance and help. And our economy being in such a terrible shape after the war and after the Great Depression, the resounding attacks that took on our economy, something had to be done to put people back to work. Government had to step in to try and help everyone. That's an extraordinary circumstance. You know, out of that we saw Social Security, which was supposed to ensure that as we got older, we would pay in a certain amount of sum our lives, part of our paychecks. But then when we retired, we wouldn't be penniless, which nobody had hardly anyone had a pension plan back in the day when that came into being. And this was seen as a way for people, when they had worked their entire lives, they had put in X amount of dollars into the system. When they go to retire, there would be something for them. It would be their money that was compounded over many years through however the government secured it. You know, we didn't have the lockbox that Al Gore wanted us to have, which we probably should have had. But when you leave money laying around and politicians are around, they are not going to do what's right with it. They're going to do what they feel they want to do with it. And unfortunately, that's what happened. But the Social Security was one of those socialist things that kind of came out of that error that we needed government to step in. I'm not saying to be socialist, but to step in and to try and provide the people with some assistance to buoy everyone until the economy could get going again. Now, we've seen that again recently, right? We had a burgeoning, crazy economy going under President Trump, and then we saw the coronavirus attack the world, and we saw the American economy shut down, and the economy has faltered now. So at this point, we're seeing the government giving out trillions of dollars to people. Now, when you look at the actual amounts that they're giving people, it seems a pittance. I mean, if somebody is making, you know, what's the average salary in America? What do they call it? The mean salary, the average salary? $65,000. Now, in some parts of the country, if you're making $65,000, you are the king of the hill. Either here in the Northeast or in, you know, California, $65,000 barely covers your basic life expenses. It's very hard to live on $65,000, not because you're living some lavish lifestyle. It's just the cost of housing, food, energy, and the things that you need to survive every day. Well, when we see this party, the Democrat Party, listing slowly to the left over the years, we saw that a lot of the people in the party, the politicians, were in love with the Soviet Union. They thought it was great. Even Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders, who is an avowed socialist, he honeymooned, right? I think he honeymooned in Moscow because he was so enamored with them. We see so many of our friends on the left who seem to think that Castro's regime was the greatest thing that ever happened to the people of Cuba. You know, of course, they have the greatest medical care in the entire world. Everyone knows that. I mean, of course, because that's what you get when you have a socialist government. But we saw that slow drift to the left that in days gone by, I remember them, if you called them a socialist, they would lose their minds. They were not socialists. They were Democratic Republicans and Democratic people who believed in democracy. And any hint of connection to socialism or communism was fought back vehemently. But over the years, we don't see that anymore, do we? Not only do we don't see them fighting back, we see them openly embracing socialism. Matter of fact, it's the next wave, what they see for America as being the best way to go forward. We see young people, literally millions of young people now, who are not only enamored with socialism, they actually believe it is the best way to go. Poll after poll reveals this. And now we have candidates who are so radicalized and so far to the left that we're seeing the problems we have today in America. We're seeing our cities burn. We're seeing riots. We're seeing citizen versus citizen. People can't talk to each other. People have cut off family members. It has become, this is actually the point of change. You know, I talked about the crossroads for a long time. We're beyond the crossroad now. We're now in uncharted and new territory where this is going to go. And this election really pits us at that point. And one of those points that you can look at as a barometer for how things are going is how our police officers are treated, how police officers are viewed, and what certain governmental people are doing about law enforcement. So when I say that, I was around for 9/11 when it actually happened. I was on the job. I was a police officer. And after watching those brave men and women, firefighters, police officers, Port Authority, NYPD officers trudge in and out of that building until they collapsed, and we lost so many of our first responders, as well as, you know, how many thousands of our citizens who were working in the building. We saw a reverence for law enforcement. We saw an appreciation not only for the sacrifices of those officers that died in that attack, but we saw, you know, the local cop in your town was now viewed as someone who was important, who was doing something really good for the community, a person of value. And it was evident. You could feel it when people would see you and they were, you know, giving the thumbs up and really supportive of police and firefighters and first responders. Well, the effects of the drift to the left is that you have to undermine the underpinnings of a society and for it to go left, especially a democracy like ours. So for us to go left, we have to uncable ourselves to the traditions and the things that have moored us to democracy and a democratic republic. One of those things is confidence in our law enforcement. Because if we don't have confidence in law enforcement, then we have to do something else to provide for national security internally within the country, which means we have to look at the governmental proceedings that make that work. So if we get rid of the cops, you know, defund the police, decouple ourselves from belief that the cops are good, then we have an opportunity to do something else. That is this all symptomatic of a move to the left. And it's no longer hidden. Like I said, back in the day, they would hide it and it was whispered about socialism. Now it's not whispered. Now it's screamed from the rooftops that this is an important thing and socialism is the way to go. And I think thinking people can look at that situation and say, do we have examples anywhere in the world where socialism would work for all of our people in our country? Now, of course, you're going to, oh, what about the Scandinavian countries? No, the Scandinavian countries are small, homogeneous countries that are nothing like America. So while they can take 70% of people's income there and give them free health care, that would not work in the United States of America when we have such a diverse population. such a diverse population of income, of people, of races, of how people get along, of working conditions, the kind of jobs we do, the economy we have, to just say one size fits all, as in socialism, would be a fool's errand, because it would not work here under those conditions. Look at Venezuela, which was a country that had a huge economy based on its natural resources. They became wealthy. They were probably going to be a leader of South America. And then they went socialist. And we saw what it was exactly the same things we saw here. The pattern of socialism as it develops is the same. We saw unrest in the streets. We saw a decoupling from traditional values, decoupling from traditional institutions. We saw tearing down of statues. We saw the violence in the streets, the retribution against those that they felt had wronged them. And then the falling apart of the society, the starvation, the hunger, and then the strength of the military man who comes in to basically quell the violence and keep the people under control. And once again, we would have the, everyone's equal, but some are more equal than others. You know, George Orwell and his Animal Farm is a perfect example of where this leads. So the attacks on our police, the way our society has now moved because of a relatively small number of incidents. Now, let me give you the caveat. Anytime anyone is injured or killed in an interaction with law enforcement, it is bad. It's a tragedy for the person, for the family, and for the country. But as I have said many times, if you don't look into the exact facts of the incident that led to someone. Now, people are out there protesting, making it sound like it's thousands and thousands of people are mowed down by the police out of hatred of racism for no reason. They just go kill people and they feel they can get away with it, and they do get away with it. When we see last year, there were 9 unarmed African Americans who were killed by law enforcement. Now, initially, you say 9, that's a horrendous number, even though there's 350 million people. 9 people killed by law enforcement for no good reason is not acceptable. Then you have to look into the circumstances. Now, if a man is just walking up the street and the police decide, hey, I don't like black people, I'm going to stop this man, argue with him, punch him, beat him, and then I'll shoot him and kill him, that would be a capital crime that officer committed. And I think every cop in the world would be happy to slap the handcuffs on that officer and take them away. But that's not what happens. When we look at these incidents, we see that there's almost always some reason the police were brought into contact with the person. Cops just don't ride down the street and go, hey, let's go get that guy. There's some reason that they're brought together. Then the interaction goes bad. Now, sometimes it goes bad because of the way the officer acts, the stance that the officer might take, the way they verbalize themselves. The other person gets offended. They get upset. Maybe they've actually done something and they don't want to be arrested. They don't want to be held to account. That is where the essence of the conflict then begins. Now, whether it was started by inappropriate verbiage by law enforcement or on the actions of the person, it ends up escalating. Now, there's almost always some form of violence in these things, whether it's resisting, running, fighting with the officer, that puts the officer in fear for their life. And we can talk about that till we're blue in the face. What is there to be afraid of? Well, I got to tell you, if someone is choking you out because they're bigger than you, they don't need a gun to kill you, right? So what I'm saying is, any time that there's a death because of an interaction with law enforcement, we have to look at it very, very carefully. If there was criminal behavior on the part of the officer, they have to be held to account. There's no way a society can survive without it. I wouldn't want that to happen to somebody in my family. And I don't think any good cop out there would. But we have to look at all the facts. What led up to the conflict? And then you have to always remember, cops are not out there with the obligation to get beat, stabbed, shot, choked, run over by a car, hit, beat, or any other type of injury just because you're a cop. You're not obligated to do that. You're obligated to enforce the law. This is the part that we really don't hear a lot about. The other side is, as a citizen, you have an obligation to obey the law and obey the lawful orders of a police officer, even if you disagree with what they're saying. If they say you're under arrest, guess what? You're under arrest. I wouldn't like it if somebody pulled me out of the car and arrested me for something I didn't do. But for whatever reason, they thought I did it. Maybe I was in the area. Maybe somebody saw my car, thought it was me, and they're going to arrest me. I'd be very angry. I'd be very upset about it. But I would do what I was told, I would be arrested, and then I would get a lawyer, and I would sue the hell out of them. Okay? That is how our system is set up. You don't resist, you don't fight, you don't punch, you don't make your case out on the street. And too many of our citizens, especially now, seem to believe that that is their option. Well, if they don't agree with the law, if they don't agree with what the officer is telling them to do, they can fight. That's their obligation to fight back. That's their right. And it's really not. That leads to chaos, and that leads to conflicts where people get hurt. So every single incident has to be viewed in that glass. What caused this incident to happen? Was the cop right or wrong? If the cop was wrong, they got to face the consequences. It's as simple as that. But if the citizen was wrong and brought that situation on themselves, we have to be able to say that too. Otherwise, we're not being honest with ourselves. So the attacks on police officers are increasing because decoupling our nation from reliance on law enforcement as a viable societal tool is what we need to do if we want to go socialist. And that's what they're doing. So the attacks we're seeing where officers are sitting in their police cars and somebody walks up and just shoots in the car and tries to kill them, like we just saw recently. Everybody saw it on social media. In California, the two CHIPS officers or the sheriff's officers were shot point blank by somebody who just walked up to their car. If they're willing to do that to a law enforcement officer, what do you think they'll do to you and your family? Right? We see people yanked out of their cars on the highway. Just recently in Philadelphia, there's some video at a park. Some people just driving through this park, and there's a whole group of people with masks on and black hoodies, and they're going up with hammers, smashing out the windows, attacking people. We're seeing more and more incidents of this kind of thing. Here in New Jersey, recently in Camden, New Jersey. Camden is a place that's been known as a very violent city for a long time. A lot of crime in that city. We saw two officers who were married, apparently, and they have a small child, and somebody rode up to their house and fired gunshots into their home, into their private home, where they were in that house with their small child. Now, I can't think of anything, any reason whatsoever, that that would be considered an appropriate form of voicing your opinion on how you think police do their work. Right, these individual officers and that little baby, they deserve to have somebody shooting guns into their house. If you think that, if you see that as a reasonable and a viable way to voice your opinion on law enforcement, then I'm going to tell you, honestly, as someone who cares about people, you need to go to a psychiatrist and have them speak to you and see if they can figure out what your bigger problems are. Because rolling up to somebody's private home and shooting through their windows while they're in there with their child is a sick act, a depraved act, and it's another symptom that shows us how far down the road we are come. As the further we go left, the more violence we're going to see. Open up your eyes, go out and look at the examples all around the world as this happens, and the attack on our police officers is the first symptom that we're seeing. This is Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I'll be back in a minute with more Chasing Justice.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep, but it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
As we say, let the silent voices be heard. Shadow banning, editing, censorship, blocking, and adherence to political correctness are seen as serious threats to our God-given right to free speech. Suppressing free speech, the very cornerstone of our society, is not in the best interest of our listeners, readers, and those who provide our content. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Welcome back, my friends, to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. And as you can see, I am not in a manic mood today. I'm not screaming and hollering as I go through my pages of outrages, because I'm trying to think about things in a little more of a analytical kind of way. I'm looking at what's going on in our country, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, we just talked about the attacks on our police as a symptom of the move to the left and how we're trying to survive that as we come into this election. You know, that's a part of a bigger symptom of the crumbling of safety in our society. Okay, so you have the decoupling of the reliance on the police, you know, stop the police from doing their job, slow them down, go after the police personally. They're physically attacking police officers in their cars. People are being shot and killed. And now we're seeing them attack police officers' houses. And we hardly hear a word. That should have been such an outrage that happened in Camden, New Jersey, across the country. That in itself should have been enough to stop this entire thing cold where it was. Instead, it was barely covered. Barely a word was said about it. Right? There's many people out there who applauded it and who think that's the best way to respond. Let's go get them for a change, right? Like I said, if you think that, if you believe that, you need to go get a checkup from the neck up, so to speak. But it's this crumbling of our safety. Now, we have a safety net, financial safety net, right? If somebody falls into a situation where they don't have enough income, we have lots of social programs to try and help people. If people don't have healthcare, there's welfare programs for healthcare for people. Well, we also have a safety net that we don't even see. We don't even always recognize. That's the safety net in the background of our lives, where you can assume that the police are out there to protect us. That if you see a police car in the neighborhood, you usually feel pretty good about that. Unless, of course, you're slinging dope or doing some other crime, then seeing the cop car in the neighborhood is not a good thing. You wouldn't care for that. But the rest of us, the huge majority of Americans, when you see a cop car, you know, it's like, hey, there's a cop in the neighborhood, which means the burglars are not going to be in the neighborhood, right? The people that would steal your car are not going to be in the neighborhood. The people that are going to be doing bad things to your family members are not going to be in the neighborhood because you got a cop car riding around. You know, that's one of the ideas of having police presence in our communities, not to intimidate us, to scare us, to make us feel on edge. They're there to protect when we need us. Now, I have said all along, I'm a teacher and trainer, and that's what I do. I teach police officers, I train them. And do we need to increase our de-escalation skills? We do. Do we need to make sure that our officers interact appropriately with everyone, starting from a level of respect? Right? I think we do. And I don't think we teach enough of that. But I got to tell you, one of the things we need to talk about is the job of a police officer. You know, everyone thinks they know what it's like, but unless they've strapped on the gun and the uniform, got in the car, and went out and actually did the work, they really have no idea what it's like. I talked to a lot of my civilian friends over the years, and they would say, oh, it must be cool to be a cop. You ride around, do whatever you want to do, right? And you know, you're stopping people, you're arresting people. Well, that is certainly part of the job, arresting people, stopping cars, you know, enforcing the law. That's what that's about. You know, that's the job, to enforce the laws. When you enforce the laws proactively, that is where we can run into a little bit of a problem. Because you can get, there's an individual culture of an agency. And if that agency is very proactive, you have proactive officers, proactive administrators who say, listen, we're going to keep the community safe by proactively going out there and looking for crime as best as we can. That means you're going to have officers who are looking for violations to stop people and to summons and ticket them. And if you find illegal activities, to arrest them. The whole idea being that the notification kind of goes out to the community that this is not a place where you commit crime or do bad things. We all know there's communities like that, right? That you go to and they have a real law and order kind of a thing. You don't screw around in that town because they take it seriously. And then we know there's other towns where they don't take it quite so seriously. And a lot of things go on. You'll see an increase in crimes of nuisance crimes, disorderly persons things, vandalism, You'll see garbage all over the place. These are a result of how the police job is done. So if we look at the example of New York City, and I was just talking with my daughter about this, who going to college in New York City, and it's a concern right now with all of the potential violence that's out there, especially on our college campuses, of what's going on in the world. I remember the 1970s and the 1980s, New York City was such a dangerous, horrific place to go. You would never really consider going there for fun, to go for dinner. You know, there was always Broadway in the plays, but you took your life in your hands to go there. You could get mugged. There was 3,000 murders in New York City a year. 3,000 murders. And I remember it was coming to a crescendo, that the crime was getting worse and worse. When you see New Year's Eve on TV now, and you see that beautiful Times Square, and there's, what do they set up, bleachers so you can go, if you've never been there, they set up bleachers in the middle of Times Square. You can sit there and people watch, and they made it a walking place, so there's no vehicles there anymore. And there's restaurants and food and all the bright lights. It turned into a beautiful, amazing place in the middle of New York City. You felt the vibrancy of the city. Well, if you go back to the 1970s, Times Square was nothing but peep shows, prostitutes, sex shops. It was, and physically filthy and dangerous. There was bad people everywhere. You could be mugged. You could be shot. It was absolutely horrific. And how did that change? You know, what changed that? New York just didn't, you know, wake up one day and decide, well, let's be better. There was this growing crescendo of violence. And I'll never forget, there was a young man and his family were visiting from the Midwest somewhere. And I apologize, I don't remember his name. But they were visiting from the Midwest and they were accosted by some people on the subway. You know, you go to New York, you take the subway, right? You're in the New York subway, right? And they were accosted by some criminals who were in the subway, tried to rob him, and they ended up shooting and killing this young man. And he died on the filthy, dirty steps of the New York City subway with his family there. That shocked even the liberal left-wing New Yorkers, who at that point, you know, New York is a left-wing city, always has been, that they had to do something. You could no longer function in that city. It was that bad. And, you know, anybody who never saw it, who wasn't there, who isn't old enough at this point to have remembered that, what that was like, you can't even imagine a place being so bad. I was there as a young person, and I didn't like it. I wouldn't go back. I wouldn't take my wife, at the time my girlfriend, to the city. It was horrible. Well, that after that young man was murdered there, there was a hue and cry that even our left-wing friends in the city realized, we have to do something about this. And sometimes in America, more occasions than not, when there is a situation that requires a hero to rise, we will find that hero rising. And we can see this example over and over and over again. But in this case of New York, it was Rudy Giuliani. And Rudy Giuliani was a prosecutor, a federal prosecutor. He was a tough as nails kind of guy. And he went after the organized crime, especially Italian organized crime. You know, the mafia that everybody said didn't exist at the time. Rudy Giuliani was a brave prosecutor, because you can imagine going up against organized crime at that time, which had a stranglehold on the city. And he went after the big people, the heads of the five families, and he took them down. He arrested them, put them in prison. He dismantled a lot of their money-making capabilities. Now, of course, organized crime, like anything else, still continues, but it does not continue the way it did in the 1970s and the early 1980s. So when Giuliani came in, he had a theory. You know, how are we going to make this out of control? I wouldn't even call it the Wild West. The Wild West had its, most of the time was nice and calm until the banditos or the bad guys, or whatever they called them, came into town and shot the place up. This was a 24/7 chaos going on in New York. Rudy came in and he brought in, I believe it was Bill Bratton, as his police commissioner, and they had a concept, and that was the broken windows theory. And the idea was, if you allow little things, little crimes to take place, then bigger crimes will take place, because people who are committing these things will feel empowered and emboldened to do more because they got away with little things. You know, they painted graffiti on something, or they robbed somebody and took their wallet, or they punched them in the face and nothing happened, or they smashed a window and nobody did anything. So that's where the theory of broken windows comes in. You had people jumping the turnstiles. You had there was a thing called wilding that went on, where large groups of teenagers would go through the park and just terrorize people that were there with their families and rob everybody, beat everybody up, and take off. It was a horrific situation. So the new mayor came in and said, "I'm going to do law and order, and we're going to do our broken windows theory." So what we're going to do is we're going to make sure that little things are attended to. If you jump the turnstile, you'll be arrested and you'll be held to account. If you vandalize, you'll be arrested, you'll be held to account. If you possess drugs, you'll be arrested, you'll be held to account. You get the idea? They didn't let the little things go. Not only in the course of arresting somebody who was jumping a turnstile, would you catch somebody who was breaking that minor law, right? Jumping out on a dollar fee to ride the train. You would find a gun and drugs in their pocket. Now, that same person that was jumping the turnstile, that was possessing a gun and drugs in their pocket, would later on that afternoon rob somebody, beat them over the head, maybe rape them, or shoot and kill them. So by getting that person off the street that morning, and you arrest them, and boom, off they go into the system, you've now taken a gun off the street and a violent person. And he empowered the police to do their job. Now, this was a battle in the beginning because criminals do not like to be stopped, right? They do not like to be held to account. But at that time, the people in the city were so sick and tired of the violence that they were willing to allow the cops to do their job. And the police did. That is the police job. That is the police response when there's crime, to go out and clean up an area, find the people committing the crime, and hold them to account. Well, this was so successful in New York, that New York went from 3,000 murders a year, a lawless, dangerous place, to considered one of the safest big city in the country. 3,000 murders went down to 300. Now, you say to yourself, 300 murders? That is crazy. If my town had 300, no, your town is not made up of, you know, 8 million residents and another 5 million visitors every day. So that's a lot of people. 300 murders is really not an outrageous number of murders when you have that many people involved interacting in that close of quarters. So to go from 3,000 to 300 was a huge change. The philosophy in the city was, if you walk around with a gun to commit crime, the cops are going to get you, and you're going to go to prison, right? So the prison population swells. Now, You can have sociologists talk to you till you're blue in the face and say, well, you know, who was it that was being arrested? And I'll tell you, it was the people that had the guns. All right? You can't change it any other way than that. The people who were shooting, committing the crimes, that's who was getting arrested. It's unfortunate that it doesn't fit our sociological need to not have that happen. But that's who they were going after. People that were committing crime, they flooded neighborhoods that were besieged with crime, where the residents couldn't live safely in that neighborhood. So that's where you send your cops. That's how you do police work. You send them where they're needed. Now, what I said earlier was that when you have a proactive law enforcement agency, proactive work means you go out and you look for criminal activity and you go after it. You don't wait for somebody to call you to tell you, hey, they're selling drugs in the park. You get information drugs are being sold in the park. You go in there and look for it. You find the drug dealers and you arrest them. That's proactive work. If you have a lot of traffic accidents in your town, that's probably something you can actually understand if you have a low crime area, but there's traffic accidents. Maybe you have a highway, a county road that's very busy, and there's a lot of traffic accidents there. How do you prevent those accidents? Well, the police response to that would be to send police cars out there, visible symbols of law enforcement. And that tells people, hey, the cops are watching. What happens when you're on the highway and you're zipping along doing 75 miles an hour in a 65 mile an hour zone and you see that cop car on the side of the highway? What do? Well, most people, you take your foot off the gas or you slow down, you hit the brakes, right? Uh-oh, you follow the law when you see the cops are there because you don't want to get pulled over and get a ticket. Well, that's how you attack accidents in an area. You put officers out there and they look for, you know, blatant violations. You know, maybe everybody makes this left-hand turn every day and there's 10 accidents a week where people are injured, cars are destroyed because people make the illegal left-hand turn. When you got the cops sitting there and they see the illegal left-hand turns and they start stopping people, hunking out tickets, eventually the word gets out that, man, if you make that left-hand turn, you're going to get stopped and get a ticket. And who wants a $200 ticket? So people stop making the left-hand turns. You see, you make the area safer. If you don't allow the violation to continue, you'll have less of the problem that the violation results in. That's the same thing with criminal behavior. If you allow people to commit small crimes, they will certainly feel they can commit bigger crimes. If I'm allowed to walk around and jump a turnstile and not have to pay when everyone else has to pay to get on the train, I can feel like, hey, you know what? You're standing here by yourself talking to your cell phone. I can go over to you and just take that cell phone out of your hand because nobody stopped me jumping the turnstile. So guess what? I'll just take that phone. Maybe they'll take your wallet, maybe your briefcase. You know what? Maybe they'll sexually assault you if they decide that, hey, there's nobody around and there's nobody to stop me. And that's what I feel like doing. Now, this is a reality of how criminal behavior works. This is what police base their responses to. Cops just don't go somewhere because they don't like a group of people and attack a neighborhood. That's not how it goes. You know, you have an aggressive group of law enforcement officers that what they want to do, they don't want to aggressively hurt people. They want to go out and protect people aggressively. They want to get the crime out of a neighborhood so the grandmother can walk to the store without getting assaulted, so that the young kids can walk around the neighborhood and not be assaulted, so that anyone can enjoy the neighborhood and live their life without being injured, molested, or killed because of criminal activity. Now, when a crime gets so bad in an area and people are willing to allow the police to do their work, the police will go in and clean up that area. This is what has happened over and over and over again in many communities. What we're seeing now with this violence out in our streets, with this unrestrained attack on buildings and property and people, have we seen that go down or have we seen an increase in it? Very clearly, we've seen it increase because nobody is stopping it. It's the exact same philosophy. If you let the little things go, they'll get bigger. Well, we've decided to let people burn buildings down, smash out store windows, and loot them. Now we're seeing people shooting police officers who are sitting on the side of the road, not doing any police work, just sitting there watching the world go by, and they're being attacked. Officers are being attacked in their beds at night in their homes. And what I say over and over again, if they're willing to do that to a police officer, what will people in the criminal world be willing to do to you and your family? You see, so this crumbling of our safety net, the safety net that we all take for granted, is another symptom of moving to the left. Now think about it. Do you feel safer today than you did a year ago? Would you go to a city and walk around like you would a year ago? Would you wear a MAGA hat and go into Chicago? Why not? What do you think would happen to you if you went to one of our major cities? Or how about if you just went in with an American flag? What do you think would happen to you? Has the violence gone up or the violence gone down? It's a symptom of our drift to the left. We'll be back in a minute with more Chasing Justice.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue: Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. Now, listen, one of the things I talk about here a lot is my relationship with law enforcement. And as many of you know, I write a lot of articles. I write a lot here for the platform on AmericaOutloud.com. I try to voice my opinion and give you some insights into how I see things and hope it gets you thinking. I certainly don't want you to have to think like I do. I want you to think for yourself, but I give you some insights, and that's how we all increase our knowledge and our ability to think, is to take ideas and take them apart in our own head with what we think about them. So one of the things that I've done to help my law enforcement community is I've written a book, and this book is called The Interview. And it is a learning guide for every person in law enforcement, whether it's police officers, corrections officers, sheriff's officers, prosecutors, detectives, investigators of any kind, people in uniform, people in plain clothes, narcotics units, anybody. This book, The Interview, basically is a rundown of how to conduct a proper police interview so that you can get admissions, confessions out of people. It's about building a bond with people. It's about learning how to do the most vital thing that any police officer will ever do, and that is to connect with another human being to get the information that they need. So this book is available from my publisher, which is looseleaflaw.com, looseleaflaw.com. And right now they're offering a special on this book, which I'm telling you would make a great Christmas gift for any law enforcement officer that you have in your family or a friend or anybody that you know. Maybe you want to get a couple copies and drop it off at your local PD and see if you can help your officers down there if you don't have anybody in the family who's law enforcement. The Interview, it's looseleaflaw.com. And you can find that by going there, put my name in Pangaro in the toolbar, and it pops right up. Right now, they're offering 20% off for anyone who pre-orders, because it'll be out in November at some point. But you can pre-order it now by going to that site, purchasing the book, and at checkout, there's a code. It's PTGOCT2020. All right, PTC for Pangaro Training Guide, OCT for October, and then 20, not 2020, just 20, for the 20% discount. Pangaro Training Guide, PTG, OCT, 20. You get 20% off, so you can get a couple of them if you wanted to send them out to law enforcement people that you care about. Another thing that we're offering, another option for you, is we know Lieutenant Randy Sutton, who is a tremendous voice for law enforcement, and Randy started a group called the Wounded Blue, and he's out there helping injured police officers who've been injured in the line of duty. It's a tremendous organization. We fully support him here at Chasing Justice. And personally, what I asked the publisher to do was find a way to get some money from the sale of this book to go to Randy's group. So if you make a purchase at looseleaflaw.com, buy a nice Christmas present for a law enforcement officer you care and love about. And when you put in the code at checkout, you can put in PTG for Pangaro Training Guide, PTGWB for Wounded Blue, 10. Okay? PTGWB 10 is the code. And a portion of every sale of that book will go to Randy's group, the Wounded Blue. We can help some of our police officers who are truly in need of our support and our love and care. All right, that's enough about that. The Interview, help a cop with it. All right, so what are we seeing on a political world? Because I've been talking about the police and how our police agencies are being treated and how that's a symptom of moving to the left, how we're seeing the chaos and the crumbling of our American safety net, safety like health and welfare safety, you know, not getting hit over the head and robbed, how that is changing as we drift to the left. What's going on with our politics? Well, we saw recently the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is a associate justice on the Supreme Court. Now, I tweeted out from at Pangaro Global. That's my handle there, at Pangaro Global. I tweeted out when I heard that she had passed away that, you know, regardless of whether I liked her decisions, which for the most part I did not, she's a human being, and she died, and she was in service to our country. Now, we don't have to like the service she provided, but she was in service to our country. And her family, I'm sure, mourns her death. And she's a loss to her family and friends. And I want to make sure that we, you know, at least thought of her as a human being, as a person, you know, not just as a political figure. So even if you disagree with her, she passed away. And, you know, she has to deal with God now with her decisions and what she made in the course of her life. But her family, I'm sure, they miss her terribly. and we're sorry for them, you know, that they lost somebody they care about. But her death has left an opening now on the Supreme Court. Now, one of the things we've seen with the Supreme Court, with the election of Donald Trump, and why presidential elections are so important, because while a president can influence the world of America very strongly for 4 or 8 years, the time that they're president, the judges that they pick can influence the country for many, many, many years to come and actually change the nature of our country and how we get along and the things that we do. So we've all seen over the years with the drift to the left, some of our judges, especially most, well, I got to be honest about it when we look at it, Republican judges that are supposed to be considered conservative, constitutionalists, you know, law and order kind of guys and girls, they get put on the court and they drift left themselves. And they can become some of the biggest liberals that we've ever come across on the court. But you don't see that the other way. You don't see a very liberal judge appointed to the court that they drift to the right and become more constitutionally oriented, more, Republican type of a thing. No, they don't do that. They stay left and go harder left, and the right judges go left and sometimes go real hard left. Now, we've seen that with Justice Roberts, who was touted as going to be a great conservative jurist. His cases, his whole life, he presented... his outcomes were very conservative for the most part, which is why he was picked by a Republican president. He was even made the Chief Justice because people had so much faith in what he was going to do. Unfortunately, we're seeing he's one of these Republican conservative justices who were appointed, who are listing to the left and becoming more and more liberal, where he is now the Sandra Day O'Connor swing vote on the court. He can go with the liberals on this one, maybe conservatives on that one. And we really don't have a solid conservative block that you can count on when some of these national questions come up before the court to make conservative, constitutionally based answers, which is difficult. So that's why the president, the election of the president, is important. So now Ruth Bader Ginsburg has passed away before the end of the Trump term, which goes till January 20th of 2021, and an election coming up in a very short period of time. So the question comes up, should President Trump nominate a judge for the Supreme Court, or should he defer till after the election to see who wins? Because if Biden wins, you know, people would have voted and said, we want to go left wing, we want to go socialist, we want to have a socialist judge. We want Joe Biden to pick the judge. Or should Donald Trump nominate somebody now, and the Republican Senate controls the Senate, should they confirm that justice before the election or before the end of the Trump term? That's the big question right now, okay? So a couple of ways we look at this. Garland Jeffries, I believe that was his name, was an Obama judge that was up for nomination before the most recent election, before the 2016 elections. And I think it was in February before the elections. And there was a big hue and cry from a lot of Republicans that, hey, this isn't right. You can't pick somebody in the last 8 months of a presidential term. The next president should make the choice. And that argument won the day. Now, you can argue with that. It was right. It was wrong. And now today you say, well, aren't the Republicans hypocritical? Because now they're all saying, McConnell says he's going to give a vote to a Trump nominee. If Trump comes up with a nominee, that nominee is going to get a vote on the floor of the Senate and could very well be confirmed before the election. Isn't that hypocritical? Well, I think if we're honest, and that's what I only ask is that we be honest, I think it's situational hypocriticality. Right? How do you like that one? Write that one down. Situational hypocriticality. Not only is it fun to say, I'm trying to coin a phrase here because this is what our friends on the left have brought us to. No, back up out there. I'm not saying that being hypocritical in this instance is right, but it's true. It is hypocritical. You know, we made a case before the end of Obama that we couldn't pick a judge. And now we're in that same position, actually, weeks away from an election, and we're saying, nope, do it. Okay? Situational hypocriticality. Under normal circumstances, I would stick to that, and I would say, nope, we did that last time. We really should wait until the next president's there, because that's a That's one of the things people vote for. They vote for the president so that the president will make the picks to the courts that they believe in, right? I would have said that had I not seen the drift to the left of our country and of our Democratic friends. They have drifted so far to the left. You know, how many people are leaving the Democratic Party? And what are they all saying? The same thing. They're saying, I didn't leave the party left me. Ronald Reagan said that years ago when the drift started. You know, he was a good Democrat and the party got more and more to the left, more socialist underpinnings, and he had to leave. And that's what he said. We're seeing, you know, a lot of sheriffs. We see the mayors in Minnesota, 7 or 8 of them got together and said, you know, we can't vote for Joe Biden. He's not going to help us. Donald Trump helped us economically. So we see people jump ship when that kind of a thing happens. Do we trust our friends on the left? What if they were in charge? Let's ask yourself that question. If they were in charge today and they had a chance to put another Supreme Court justice on, win or lose on Election Day, do you think they would hold off if they had the power to do it in today's day? Not what they would have done 4 years ago or 10 years ago. What do you think they would do today? I think the answer is very clear. They would jam that through as fast as possible, and they would never look back. Our friends on the left are very organized. They are very message-centered. They stick together. They circle their wagons. If that means lying, cheating, or stealing to enhance their power, they'll do it. Our Republican friends, unfortunately, they take a higher road. They take a higher road. You know, they want to reach out across the aisle. They want to do things the right way. And what happens? The country gets screwed every time they do it. Because we have one side that doesn't care what you think. They don't care what's right. They want power. And what's the biggest linchpin to that? They have the media on their side. The media will back them up. The media will rattle the cage and repeat the message over and over and over that whatever they're doing on the left is the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. It's the proper thing to do. Well, if you ran that message constantly, people would start to believe it, right? What's that old saying? Keep telling a lie until it becomes the truth. Well, that's how human nature works. So if I would say that I could trust them to do the right thing, I would say, yeah, we can't be situationally hypocritical. But unfortunately, I know what they would do in this position. They would jam a left-wing judge down our throat so fast, we wouldn't be able to stand it. Right now, they've asked Biden, or Trump has asked Biden, please give us your list of judges, because Trump gave his list before he was elected. Here's the judges I'm going to pick from, so that people could evaluate where the court would go. Here's the people he's going to choose from. Do I like that or not? They've asked Biden, and he will not give a list. Well, there's only two reasons. One, he doesn't have a list. Or number two, the list he knows, if he put it out there, people would recoil in horror at who he would pick. You know, think of Justice Hillary Clinton, right? Or Justice Barack Obama, right? Think about that. These are the people that he would probably have on his list. So he won't come up with a list, because he doesn't want you to know who he's going to pick. See, that's the charade of the left. They can't really tell you what they believe or what they're going to do to you, because you wouldn't vote for it. Instead, they come up with, you know, these demons that we all have to attack. You know, the bad orange man is horrible to women. He's horrible to people. He's a fascist. He wants to take over the world. He wants to ruin your life. And these are the kind of messages that they put forward instead of telling you what they're going to do for you. When they do tell you, it's a little disconcerting, like Joe Biden saying, I'm going to get rid of the Trump tax cuts. Well, what do you think businesses think? What do you think businesses think when they hear that? You're going to change the tax code again back to what it was when I couldn't run my business? They're going to increase $4 trillion in income taxes. How's that going to affect you? That alone should be enough to run away. So when we hear this appointment, I have to say, I don't trust our friends on the left. They've also come out and said if they win, they're going to pack the court. They're not even hiding that anymore. They're going to add on a couple of extra Supreme Court justices if they control the Congress and the presidency so that they can have, you know, a 9-4. And never again for the next 50 years will there be a conservative decision made. There'll be nothing but socialist left-wing decisions made by the high court. They want to increase the number of states by saying, oh, let's add Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. as states, which you'd have to figure the way they vote. Those two locations vote predominantly. They vote for Democratic candidates, which means they would have four additional senators, which means they would control the Senate, right? So they control the House, they control the Senate, and they control the White House. You will never again see a conservative proposition put forward. You will see nothing but left-wing tilt and drift until we drift out of our current position as a democratic republic. You'll see us drift right into the world of socialism headlong, as fast as you can possibly imagine, as quick as they can turn off the gasoline spigot by shutting down fracking, as fast as they can take away your Second Amendment rights. As fast as they're going to do all of that, the country is going to go tumbling into socialism. And this is where, as I started out this this program, where we sit and we say, you know, we're not prone to the frailties of the rest of the world. When this happens, we absolutely are prone to the frailties of the rest of the world. This is where it starts. This drift to the left gets to a certain point that it's such a major change that we only have one choice, and that's to fight back. And that's what people are talking about. That's the grumblings behind the scene. That's why people are buying so many guns. Not to fight the government, but to fight the battles in the streets, because they're going to come. If Joe Biden wins, they're talking about violence. They're saying, if you don't vote for us, there's going to be violence in the streets. That is an outright threat to you, that if you don't vote for him, they're going to unleash the mobs on you. Listen to the words that they've said. They've all said it's not going to end even after the election. They're going to contest the election. No matter how it comes out, unless they win, they're going to contest the election until they can change it. That's what mail-in voting is about. It's about manipulating the ballot so that they can win. All of these things are clearly in place, and it's all a result of the drift to the left. Let me ask you this final question before we go. Have you heard a lot of talk about enhancing your individual rights, enhancing your liberty, enhancing your prosperity as a person? Have you heard any of that talk at all? Pro-America, apple pie, and the flag? We can't even watch sports anymore because of the drift to the left. So my friends, it's a lot to think about. I tried to be cerebral today instead of screaming and hollering. But think about it. It's your world. It's the future of your children's world. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. We'll see you next time here on Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network.